Okay, this is what is it, March 2nd here, 2004, and we're sitting in Bill Bright's beautiful condo here overlooking Puget Sound at the end of the locks,
entrance
to the locks here, and it's a sunny day, and we're waiting for the Kalakala to come by, but anyway, so we're going to talk with Bill about false path and the history of false path, and try and get that down for posterity. So, I guess, Bill, why don't you say a little about when you first went, just your history when you first went up to false path and how that happened and what it was like when you first went there.
Well, I went to false path in 1950. Actually, I was 15 years old. They thought I was a year or so older, I guess. But anyway, I rode a boat with another fella up there, and we got hired. Actually, it was the Cape Douglas Canning Corporation barges that were anchored over in Trader's Cove in front of Morsholy Village, and there were people living in Morsholy Village at the time, and a few houses there, and John Hodiakoff and the Shelikoff family, and they had a church there, and all, but we were anchored outside of them, and we were floating on about four different barges, all tied together. And we canned on one and cased up on another barge and stored canned salmon in another barge. And then we lived on another boat. The Filipino workers lived on one of the barges, the machinists, and I was in the beach gang, lived on the Vindicator, which was a 136-foot minesweeper that was chartered from Bill Lohman. And we had most of the fleet fishing for us because the large false pass cannery across the strait at its present location there depended at that time mostly on trap fishing and a few seiners from Puget Sound, from Slavonian seiners from like Gig Harbor and Everett, and they didn't depend on the local fishermen very much. And Cape Douglas wound up servicing all of the local fishermen, just about all, if not all. And we did that in 49. Canning salmon there. I didn't come up until 1950, and I was there in 51. After the 51 season, Nick Biz, who had just purchased P.E. Harris False Pass Cannery from P.E. Harris himself in 1950, he, I guess, saw the handwriting on the wall that he would need a fishing fleet. So to get his fishing fleet back, he bought out Cape Douglas. So in 1952, the whole fleet and the tenders, however, the cannery didn't need the Vargas any longer. They were named the Cape Douglas and the Orcas, and they didn't need them or the Vindicator any longer. They got the two tenders, the Glasnap and the Eisenbeck, and the fishing fleet, and the crew, a lot of the crew moved over to the False Pass cannery location, and starting in 1952, then I had joined the Naval Reserve, and I couldn't go up in the 52 season because of my reserve obligations. I had to go to San Diego for a couple weeks training. But I was back in 1953. In 1953, I was one of his deckhands on the Eisenbeck. And so, and then I was 4 years during the 50s as a deckhand on the Eisenbeck. I mean, well, 3 years in the Eisenbeck and 1 year on the Glasnost, the sister ship. And we primarily ran up to Eisenbeck Bay, hauling fish back and forth. But sometimes we would go out into Yucatan and to Marshall Bays picking up fish. And in 59, actually, it was the first time the drifters showed up on the south side, just a handful of drifters fishing around East Anchor Cove. And then we would go out and attend them in June. 58 was the last year of the fish traps, so then the push then was just fishing boats, seiners from southeastern, from Puget Sound, and then the locals started getting bigger and better boats themselves then, and so they could go further distances.
So the Bill, that that whole canning operation that was done on the Cape Douglas, that only lasted 3 years, and that was it.
Yes, yeah. Actually, they started off where they got the name Cape Douglas. They were going to go in the clam business down around Kamishak Bay, which is a beam of Kodiak Island. Actually, there's Kamishak Bay and Cape Douglas, and there had been some clam producers around in there. And of course, this was after World War II. Some of the principals, George Scarborough Sr., he'd been in the Navy as a commander in the Navy in the war. And I remember a lot of the fellas had, you know, been in the Aleutians, running boats, and doing various things through 1945. So I guess after the war, 46, you know, and around in there, then they started doing other things. And I think that, or I know Cape Douglas started out producing clams around Kamishak Bay there. But then I guess they decided to go into salmon then. So they moved down to the peninsula in 49. And we did move. We did not stay in Traitor's Cove the whole time. At the end of the season, we did move the whole, all of us, fishing boats, tenders, the four barges, and three of them was empty towed. We all moved down to Volcano Bay, which is just outside of Pavlov Bay, and we canned pinks and chums in there. And then after that, we went clear on down to a little place called Port Wrangell, which is a little bay past Chinnick, a beam of Kodiak Island, and we canned pinks in there. So we were able to move around. Of course, after the area licensing and the permits, so that if you had your own fishing fleet like we had, that sort of eliminated moving from area to area. You had to stay in your area.
All right. So, for water supply and so on and so forth, would you just find a stream and then run a pump or something with a hose, or how did you do that?
Yeah, there was a stream over in Marshalby Bay, or it's not Marshalby Bay, it's Traitor's Cove in front of Marshalby Village. There's a stream almost through town, and salmon go up. We had a big hose, about a 6-inch diameter hose that we would haul ashore and then up the stream a bit, and we'll put a little screen over it so, you know, it wouldn't take up any open stuff. But in awe. And same way when we go down to Volcano Bay and Port Morango, it's always depending upon getting a water supply.
Hmm.
One thing about Falls Pass, one of the best things that Falls Pass has always had, they have a good water supply. It's good water. In fact, Coast Pilot, which is, most ships have a copy of the Coast Pilot. If you read the Coast Pilot, they always say that some of the best water there is at Falls Pass Cannery, and if you need water to go in and tie up the dock and get water there, and they have their own water supply on the hillside west of the cannery, behind where John Nichols lives now. There's his dam water supply. It's a stream that comes actually right out of the hillside there, and a very small little dam. You probably wouldn't need a dam at all because the water comes right out of it. That supplies the cannery.
So then, when that whole operation folded, you ended up at Falls Pass still.
Yeah, then I could have been 52, but I had to go to reserves and Naval Reserve down in San Diego. So George Scarbo Jr., my good buddy, he wound up working for the Falls Pass Cannery, M.P.E. Harris, then in 52. I didn't come and start until 53. So then quickly on me, after the 59 season on the tender, they asked me, and I had my service time in. I had spent 2 years active duty also. I missed 2 years active duty during the 50s in the Navy. And so after the 59 season, they asked me to move into the office to become a cannery crew keeper. And then I was hired by your dad, Ray Puttycomb there, and Bill Lilly and Don Rawlinson. Don Rawlinson was the superintendent. Bill Lilly was the general superintendent. And Ray Puttycomb was the controller, the accountant for all the company. And so the difference there was it become a year-round job. Actually, I made less money that first year working year-round than I would this seasonal with this overtime. But it was a year-round job. Where before it was just seasonal at the end of the season, regardless of what job you had, whether you was a cannery foreman or a machinist or a tenderman or a beachman or a beach boss, at the end of the season, bang, you was all through. But the superintendent and the bookkeeper of each operation didn't have a year-round job because there was some accounting and bookkeeping and boarding to do in the wintertime in the Seattle office.
And Bill Lilly was the superintendent then, and Don was...
Okay, and when I was hired, Don Rawlinson was the superintendent. Bill Lilly had been the superintendent at Falls Pass in 54 and 55. Carl Paulus came in 56 and 57, the superintendent of Falls Pass, Bill Lilly, then become the general superintendent, which P.D. Harris also owned, Hawk Inlet down in southeastern Alaska, and they also had an operation in Crystal Bay in Mactic. And so Bill Lilly was overall superintendent for all the operations in home. He was vice president and general superintendent. But then in 58, Don Rawlinson became the superintendent. He had started off at Falls Pass in 1954 as a storekeeper. and he drove to Bristol Bay. As a bookkeeper at Bristol Bay's, and being a smart fellow, he learned the business fast, and even though he was a quite young for being a superintendent, he had the experience and the know-how to become superintendent there in 58. However, Bill really did spend quite a bit of time at Falls Pass and to probably making sure everything was going okay there too.
When did the PAF come into it?
Okay, 1965. Okay, PAF was a large company, Pacific American Fisheries, and they had canneries. In fact, most canneries in Alaska. Alaska Packers is large too, but PAF, or Pacific American Fisheries, headquartered out of Bellingham, Washington, was the largest, and they had canneries in southeastern Alaska. They had canneries on Kodiak, they had canneries on the peninsula, and they had canneries in Bristol Bay.
They had Moeller, they had King Cove, they had the Dillingham operation.
They decided it was actually a stockholder. You could buy stock in PAF on the New York Stock Exchange. In fact, I had made a small investment just to buy a little bit of stock, just to know who was who in the company. Not having much money in them days, but I was a stockholder myself, very minor, in PAF. But there was some guys, it was, I guess, corporate raiders that found out that the stock was selling for a lot less than what the assets was worth. And so they started buying up one guy from Las Vegas, Nevada, started buying stock and others. And then they decided to sell off and then in pieces. The PAF canary in Petersburg was sold, and the superintendent there got some backing in town, and then they bought the canary, and that was the beginning of, they changed the name into Icicle Seafoods, which still exists today as a large player in the Alaska seafood industry.
That's really what happened, huh? I never knew that.
The Alitak cannery was sold to Columbia Ward's fishery. Alitak was located on Kodiak Island. But Nick Biz and P.E. Harris bought then the Westward operations, which was left of PAF, which included King Cole, Port Moeller, Dillingham, and also their operation on the Naknek River in Bristol Bay. However, in the meantime, prior to 1965, when this was done, our sales department wanted to change the name from P.E. Harris to one of our major brands in the seafood industry, which is Peter Pan Seafoods. Peter Pan has the exclusive right to that name in all seafood, crab, shrimp, salmon, swordfish. They can't make peanut butter. A lot of people thought Peter Pan peanut butter was the same, but it isn't. You can have Peter Pan, which I always thought was sort of a Mickey Mouse name. But anyway, it's used to everything, but it was one of our major brands, which we sold. Actually, we sold more fish, canned salmon, and other products, frozen and salmon and all than we produced ourselves out of our canneries. We would purchase seafood from other canneries, from even out of California, and still do, selling tuna fish and swordfish and things. But under the Peter Pan label, we do have other labels that we use around the country too in certain markets. But Peter Pan was the major label, so they changed the solution. Well, Columbia River Packers had a label called Bumblebee, which was quite popular, so they changed their name to Bumblebee Seafoods, which I don't know if it's successful or not, but it must have been. So anyway, our sales department decides to change the company's name to one of our better labels, which is Peter Pan. So that happened in 1962. So it was P.E. Harris. P.E. Harris actually is he come from the South and made his money in the gold mining up on the Yukon River, his original money. And his name was actually Prince Edward Harris. He wasn't a prince of royalty, but that was his actual name, was Prince Edward Harris. And he, and his first cannery in Alaska was Falls Pass. Afterwards, he did buy other canneries and built other canneries, mainly in southeastern Alaska, which Hawk Inlet, Rose Inlet. I know at one time he had four canneries in southeastern Alaska, but Falls Pass was his first, and I believe his money maker for many years. Southeastern was sort of up and down with the salmon runs there, and it's mostly pink salmon in southeastern Alaska, and money seems to be made in the red salmon, which Falls Pass can catch, which is very few red salmon still today compared to the southeastern Alaska.
Right. Huh, that's interesting. So PAF came in and was bought in 65, but before that it had been changed to Peter Pan already, the name.
Yeah, P.E. Harris had been Peter Pan.
Right.
So actually Peter Pan then bought out PAF, or Pacific American Fisheries.
So the now the Gillnetter Best label, was that a P.E. Harris label, or was that a PAF?
No, that was a P.E. Harris label.
Oh, okay. And then they also did get, as a matter of fact, I don't know if it came with PAF, but the Union Fish Company there in Astoria, wasn't that purchased also by at the time? And they actually had tuna for a while.
Yeah, we had a cannery down, and we bought the cannery. It was not PAF.
Okay.
In fact, I think it was Union Fish. Was the name of it.
Yeah.
On the Columbia River at Astoria. So we canned tuna there during this time, during the 60s, and I'm not sure exactly when that was closed down. I think we're still using that building maybe today as not to produce salmon, but as a warehouse.
Warehouse, yeah, I think so.
I think we warehouse salmon now from Cape Cod and Dillingham down there and label.
And I know there. The tin company, Continental or American Tin, also had big operations there too, or warehouses. They're still there, I see them. Okay, so just to share your personal history then, you want to continue on there in the 60s, or
Well, in the 60s, and of course there was no trap fish then, and we were, the local fishermen began to upgrade their boats. I was thinking now, it seems like the tendency is to do away with fish camps. When I first started out, you needed a fish camp. I'm just thinking of engines, how engines have improved. Maybe you can relate to cars. You used to meet people, you know, they had a car that lasted 2 years. They was doing good. Now you can have a car for 20 years and the engine holds up. Same with outboards and marine engines and all. And I remember in 53 on a boat going to Cold Bay, and it broke down on the way to Cold Bay. I had two engineers aboard, and it was rolling around, and it was cold and wet on the boat, and the two engineers were down the engine room trying to fix the engine, and they finally got it fixed for two or three hours to get her fixed. So it seems like the boats would have to come in periodically, and engineers and mechanics would work on their boats. And of course, at the time, you could buy a boat for, say, $15,000. And a lot of fishermen, especially Bristol Bay and Port Mooar, would actually live ashore, live in bunkhouses, eat in the galleys, and then go out in their small boats, which had just a small engine that may not have been too reliable, with maybe just a little sweet stove for cooking a pot of coffee or so. So they would meet these fish camps. Now boats are more self-contained. It costs, even for a gill netter, a couple hundred thousand dollars, but they have good engines, they have kits in them for showers, they have good cooking facilities. And actually now, down at Port Mooar, instead of going in every night to sleep in a bunkhouse, they can go down the line for 60 days, sometimes, and not even touch the dock. They'll sell the fish to a tender that comes alongside. They'll pitch their fishes with bags, and the tender will just lift the bags, weigh the bags, write them a fish ticket, and then they need fuel and get fuel from the tender, which they usually use in fuel and water. And I can stay out for, say, 60 days without even touching shore. In fact, with Pat Martins and I think Bruce Henderson, so when they get to Port Mooar, do that. And that makes it that tough for fish camps like Falls Pass to stay in existence, because though they are provide a very valuable service and probably on balance are needed, but can still exist without them, unfortunately. However, you should have, you know, one or two fish camps anyway in the area that you can come in to get repairs and supplies and all. But they can send orders in on a cannery tender, and that picks up your fish for an order from the store, and with a couple loaves of bread and some steaks, you know, and some butter and whatever you want, and then they'll bring it to you in a box. But,
then that was kind of the heyday of the when I first went to Alaska, all you saw as in terms of tenders were those World War II, like the Kathy B and the
Power Scouts.
Those were surplus World War II. That showed up after World War II, and I remember the fishermen used to come and actually eat. You know, the cook on the tender would have food and coffee, and they had groceries, and that was kind of part of that whole system that went along in the 60s and part of the 70s, I guess, too.
Yeah, these Power Scows, and they still exist. They're still running. They were very well-built boats, very heavily timbered. Apparently, when the government built something, they really overbuilt. But it happened to be that it was a big platform for fish that didn't roll a lot, which it could be sort of stationary where smaller fish boat could come alongside to deliver their fish and jump upon the tender and maybe take a shower then on the tender and maybe cook with him something in the galley for him to eat. Maybe somebody would pour him a drink or something like that too, but they would, still Columbia Wards just went out of business last year, decided to go out of business because salmon prices here today is 2004. It's with the farm fishing out of Norway and now Chile and British Columbia. It's really, I can't say ruined the market for salmon, but it's they're very competitive. And the markets around the world, especially Japan, buy fish cheaper out of Chile than they can out of Alaska, so they don't.
Go ahead and start back, huh?
Yeah, the peak of fish prices happened to be in 1988, where Peter Pan paid $2.50 a pound for reds. And they've been paying only, you know, 7-8 cents a pound for pink salmon the last few years there. So the heyday for the fishermen was 1988, where Japan wanted to get as much fish as they could. They had no supply from other places in the world. So Chile had just come on. Chile is much like southeastern Alaska. They have sort of an inland waterways there, and the trees, and they can grow salmon and pins, and they can produce, and they just astronomical how they start off very small and just kept doubling and doubling and doubling each year until it's just a tremendous amount of fish going on in the market worldwide. Japan and the Orient have always been big buyers of seafood. Seems like America now or the U.S. see more seafood now than they have, but nothing like Japan does. In fact, you go in and over there, they eat salmon for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we're here, you know, we have salmon. Where it used to be fish was on Fridays at that. But people, because the health standpoint, people are eating more fish, but it does not compare to what the Orient does. And of course, the Orient, the big things of salmon and for the fishermen in Alaska was the roe, the eggs, the caviar, the salmon egg caviar is a big delicacy in Japan, but it's never taken hold of in the U.S. But they still eat the salmon egg, but they can also get it out of the fish farms. And they're also, we sent people from the University of Washington over to Japan after the Second World War to help them grow their own fish. They grow a lot of chum salmon on Hokkaido Island. They have their own fish farms there. It's primarily chum salmon, which is the your best salmon roe, and better than red salmon roe, and better than pink salmon roe is the chum salmon. And they grow a lot of roe themselves, so they're not paying the big price that they once did to the last fisherman for their chum salmon roe.
Well, when did the egg houses start here at Falls Pass?
So, you know, ironically, we used to throw the eggs overboard. We'd with the guts of the fish when the fish would come in to our fish house there, and was cleaned by an iron chain, and those the eggs and the guts went overboard, and so there was a guy that we called Fish Egg Pete. He was a Russian. Apparently he'd walk across Russia and China to escape the Bolsheviks there. Very tough guy, and he made a deal with us to give us 10 cents a pound for our eggs, and we thought that was fat city. That's something that we've been just throwing overboard. So he came in with his own crew, and we put sort of an extension on our chinks, that there was a time where you could actually pull the eggs out of the fish. And but they were his employees, and he would take those eggs and he would saw them down, and so that he had sold them as caviar, and everybody liked him because he paid his bills right on time. If you'd give him a bill for his crew eating in the mess hall, he'd write a check right now. But we didn't know how much money he was making. He was probably selling his stuff for $2 a pound, paying us 10 cents a pound. And since it had been a waste to us, we thought it was fat city.
What year was this built?
Yeah, well, in the 60s there. Huh. And,
so it wasn't direct with the Japanese, it was this Russian guy.
Yeah, the Russians was a start. Huh. Then the Japanese, in fact, I think maybe that was one of the main reasons for them to get in the cannery. Now, I tell you what, the Japanese sort of pulled the wool down on Nick Vez's eyes, which was not the easiest thing to do. He came up, okay, he did these financing to buy the PAF canneries. So he got that from Taiyo Fisheries, which is a big fish company out of Japan. And so then they come up. Okay, this is prior to 65, so I guess, Fish Egg Pete was there maybe 61, maybe through 64. But, then the Japanese, instead of 10 cents a pound, they offered Viz $1 a pound, where they pulled the eyes over, the wool over his eyes. That it was a 10-year contract. We'll help you buy PAF with a finance, and if you sell us eggs for the next 10 years at $1 a pound, which he thought, well, from 10 cents to a dollar, sure, for a 10-year contract. In the meantime, before that 10-year contract was up, I know New England Fish Company was getting $3 a pound plus for their eggs. And we had some joint agreements with them, or we would do some custom canning for them, and then we'd give them their $1 a pound for their eggs. And they said, how come we're getting $3 a pound someplace else? And then I guess that's when we realized that we've been had. But the contract did run out after 10 years, and then it was a negotiated price then. Sort of up and down, but but then when the Japanese was taking the eggs, that's when they sent their egg crew in, and they probably had like 15 Japanese. They're supposed to be technicians, and actually they did hire locals. They hired a lot of some younger people out of the villages, a lot of young girls, say 15 years old, the native girls would work in the egg house, and then also some maybe superintendent's kids equipment and all that was too young to work in the actual cannery with machinery running. Would work in the egg house because there the egg was laid in wooden boxes with Japanese inscriptions. But it was not any machinery around where you could get hurt, so labor and industries never hollered about younger people working in the egg houses because they take the skeins of eggs and lay in these boxes and then they sprinkle salt and then they put a, you know, another layer of eggs on it. So the Japanese, then after the PAF purchase, was sent over a crew. They would probably send 8 men, which is Japanese nationals. They had a hard time speaking Japanese, but they were good guys, and wanted to be real friendly, we give them a house to live in, a false pass, and Chuck named Yapaniski or so, their 4 years old winter house, and they sometimes cook their own food, and they could eat in our galley, of course, but sometimes they had their own little dried fish and all that that they'd like. The young girls and all work, we would pay them to work in the egg house, but we'd be reimbursed for their salaries too by the Japanese. And then the Japanese would pay us $1 a pound, which we thought was good, but not that wound up quite low too.
So by this time, say around 1970, Peter Paul's Pass is still canning, and then what happened then to have it closed there for 1 year? Didn't it close for a year, 74, 75 there?
Yeah, well, 3 years.
It was poor though. Efficient for one.
Ironically, Paul's Pass was built in 1918. There, and they never had a problem with ice there, and until the end of the 60s, and I believe 69 was the first year that we lost part of our dock, and so 69, it might have skipped the years. But then back 71 and 72, the winters was very cold, and we lost our dock or part of our dock in each of those 3 years, or three different winters, in fact, including the whole fish house all in the bay. It took the dock. The fish house was a large fish house with three iron shanks and that all went into the bay. So then when we did rebuild after 72, we made a small fish house inland and part of an old warehouse, which was always the bottleneck of Paul's Pass after that. They had a very small fish house. We could can quite a bit more than we could get through our fish house. If we never lost our fish house in the main dock, it would have been the bottleneck. But we were still able to put up some big packs of Paul's Pass. In fact, the biggest pack we had was 1980, which is the last year it operated before it burned. But with the cold water, or the cold winters, about rose, the pink salmon and the stream beds, I believe, the eggs were laid in the stream beds in the summer by the pink salmon and the chum salmon, and the cold winters just rose those eggs. And starting in 73, we operated Paul's Pass, and we canned around 60,000 cases. in 73, and compared to, say, 243,000 cases on a fall basis in 1980, but we only did that little in 73. And then since at that time we also owned King Cove Cannery, which is only 40 miles away, and with the fishing and the projections low, after 73 we closed from process of Yen Falls Pass 74, 75, and 76. So it was 3 years there, but we were a fish camp, and needed what fish camps can do, repair. We had a carpenter shop, we had a machine shop, we had a mess hall, and we had, showers for the fishermen, and a stock room, and a store, and a fuel dock, and which basically we have most of those still now. And anyway, in 77, the fish came back. Actually, 76 was quite a big year for King Cove. The pinks came back like gangbusters. One thing about a fish, they can lay, hundreds of thousands of eggs, one fish. And so, even though they're down to almost zero, just a few fish can get your run back with, good climatic conditions, which is also the stream and their saltwater survival and all. There's a lot of things the salmon has to do to survive, et cetera. It goes in cycles. And one of the biggest runs in the peninsula was 76, but it also continued right up till almost today. It started in 76, and probably, I've always thought about 20 year cycles. It seems like 20 years in Southeastern, 20 years in Puget Sound, 20 years in Crystal Bay, 20 years in Port Moore, cycles. And I'm sure Route 96 is almost more fish than we can handle, at King Cove. Falls Pass burned down March 7th, 1981, a fire in the wintertime. There, we were going to move from that summer our powerhouse away from the cannery out to the field, a separate building. But just prior to that, a fire caught the power. One thing about a cannery, you have to be self-sufficient. You provide your own power, your own, that's why you have a mess hall and a store and everything. Provided the power for, at that time, we still only our wintermen in our store, but also our fuel dock. Still to this day, we sell fuel year round, and we sell groceries year round in the store. We've always kept that store open. It's a company owned store, and but it's the only store in the village. And Seafoods has kept the store and the fuel dock going. As I speak here in 2004, unfortunately, I hear rumors now that there might be a change because the owner switches to the Japanese, and I'll go back to that, how they came in to own the company next year. But through this day, and I hope it continues, that we will still be the supplier, and if not the supplier, to somebody else that can take over the store and the fuel dock there. But anyway, Nick Bez, who owned Peter Pan sequels died, and around 1974 or so. I might go get that exact date. It might have been 73, but anyway, his widow, he had two sons, and a widow, and they were worried because the fish business has always been sort of up and down, up and down. One son wanted to continue on with the business. The other son was not interested in the fish business. And I think the widow, she was well fixed if she sold the company. But if you hold a company that can't lose money, and in fact a lot of money in a year or two, you could wind up with nothing, which, you know, has happened to some companies, especially in the fish business. So she sold the Bristol Bay Native Corporation there in 1975. And the Bristol Bay Native Corporation owned us for 3 years. And they'd got some money prior from the Native Land Claims. The Native Land Claims give different Native groups around Alaska, and there was 13 groups. The 13th district was Natives that lived in the outside of Alaska area, but there's 12 Native groups. Alley Corporation, and mostly Alleys live around Falls Pass. They were one corporation, but they did not buy Peter Pan Soup, who was the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Living around Dillingham and Mackinac, around in there, they're the ones that bought Peter Pan, and the way I understood it, they bought for $8 million of cash. About 3 years later, Nichiro, a Japanese company out of Japan, paid Bristol Bay Native Corporation $20 million for the same facilities. So it was a good boon. And of course, Bristol Bay, they then I think bought the Westward Hotel in Anchorage. And I heard they didn't do so well. They made some money with the fish company, but they didn't. But I think they lost most of it to invest in other things. So they still exist, and they're doing good, and they're all good people. Up there, Bristol Bay Native Corporation. However, when it comes to fishing, they think we're catching their fish down at Falls Pass, and they think it's their fish. And, but we have our local salmon streams that don't even go close to Bristol Bay, but they think every fish in the ocean belongs to Bristol Bay, so through politics, have restricted fishing down in our area, make it very, very difficult to make a living, if possible, on fishing salmon anyway, on the peninsula. However, this recent year, looks like there has been change for this year anyway, that the fishermen on the peninsula are going to get more time.
Yeah, let's get back to that limited entry when that started later. But so Falls Pass was a fish camp until 76, and then what happened was the King Cove salmon cannery burned down. So then take it on from there, Bill.
Yeah, King Cove did burn down in the fall of 76. However, plans were in progress to open up Falls Pass in 77. Some people think it opened because King Cove burned down, but that was, but they were going to open, there was enough fish.
Because of the big fish room.
Yeah,
okay.
Projected.
Huh.
And actually in 76, King Cove couldn't really handle all the fish.
I can tell that from personal experience, I can agree with that.
Yeah.
That was a horrible summer.
In fact, there was a little
hard at work
that they might have, some fish that weren't of the highest quality, I'll just put it that way. But, so 77th False Pass was going to open again, but then, of course, it was a big mad rush to get open after the King Cole fire. And, you know, we were quite successful. We had to make quite a few changes to the cannery that the Food and Drug, you know, wanted cement floors rather than the old wooden decks. You know, the quality control, Peter Vance always been interested in quality, but there were a lot of things that we had to hurry up and do. Because it was a 1918 cannery. They didn't like, you know, machinery run by overhead belts, you know, from drives, you know, in the ceiling. It was a very old cannery. And to get it updated for the 1977, which we had to do. And so there was a lot of work involved. But by certainly 1980, and actually all those years, we got good years. Made money in 77, 78, 79, and 80. And we had five lines at Falls Pass, only one tall line that can really, you know, go through a lot of fish fast. We also had 2 half-pound lines and 2 quarter-pound lines. You can make more money if you have the time and patience to put more of your pack in halves and quarters than in tauls. It's from the sales department. But sometimes the fish come in and so fast that you have to put them in tauls. So, but it was a good crew at Falls Pass there. Some people have been there a long time. And there were people that come over from, including you, there's Steve, from King Cole there to invest in the machinists. You know, Homer, you know, Norbacus there, Norbacet.
Norbacet,
yeah.
Well, I was happy to leave King Cove. I remember when the plane came in and banked over before it went down. I think it was a Beaver, one of those smaller, whatever the name of it was, smaller plane that landed in the water. And I remember thinking to myself, man, this is my kind of place right here. And just about everybody I've talked to, some people just fell in love with Falls Pass, you know, there's just something about the place, and I've heard that from other people too, you know, with the mountain and the red cannery building and everything.
Yeah.
So that's when you became superintendent, was
77, yeah. Actually, Don Rawlinson, he was there in 74 as a fish camp. 75, they sent him to Port Mueller. So he was in Port Mueller. When Bristol Bay Native Corporation bought it, must have been right at that time, 75, Bristol Bay Native Corporation hired Jay Gage as president. John Bez was president for, I think, maybe 1 or 2 years, the son of Nick Bez, there maybe 74 and 75. They hired Jay Gage, who had been the president of New England Fish Company, as the president then of Peter Pan Seafoods. He had a philosophy of an area manager, rather than going around talking to each superintendent of each cannery in every area. He would appoint a vice president, area manager. So he appointed Ben, Don Rawlinson as the area manager for Crystal Bay. And so, and they had, you know, had floaters, they still have two floaters. And the Gillingham cannery and the NACMEC and the Warren fish camps, their operation. So, Don Rawlinson became the general, or he was the vice president and general manager. Lloyd Guffey, then, who had been the superintendent of King Coal, became the area vice president, area manager for the peninsula, which was Sand Point, Fish Camp, Squaw Harbor, and Port Moeller, King Coal, and Falls Pass. And Bill Salahak was, he had canneries in southeastern Alaska at the time, on Gimlet. And all in Puget Sound, he had a cannery in Bellingham, and he was the area manager for Bellingham, southeastern Alaska. So I become the superintendent in 77. I had been the bookkeeper starting in 1960 through 75. Actually, I think Rawlinson went to when he left, and I was just the superintendent of a fish camp, which is a big job, which you have now there, Steve, in 76. But then, of course, in 77, I had to get the cannery going. And so then I was superintendent there. And after the fire, probably ironically, they kept me at Falls Pass. They didn't want any other place. but anyway, I stayed at Falls Pass as a fish camp through 2000. So after the 2000 season, then I retired there. But actually, I'd gone up in the beach gang at Cape Douglas, which I still consider Falls Pass because of, since it was a Falls Pass in 1950 and bought out by P.D. Harris, Falls Pass, Knowledge Cannery, in 50, after the 51 season. You know, I say that I was there from 1950 through 2000, which is 50 years.
Yeah. Okay, here we are again, and we're going to talk about the history of the fish packing at Falls Pass. And Bill's going to search his mind for back right at the start there in the early, late teens there.
Okay. When I said 1918, I'm not positive that was the first year at Falls Pass. It could have been. The first 2 years the cannery was built by P.E. Harris was built over in Morshobe Bay on the eastern side of the bay across from Boiler Point. And that was the location of the cannery. And but I guess because there was a run, a red run up into Middle Lagoon and the Morshobe Bay, and then also fish coming on the South Peninsula do also go in the Morshobe Bay and circle around. One of PAF's better traps was at Boiler Point, and they were picking up traveling fish, you know, at Boiler Point there when the traps was in. And some of the bunkhouses, or the store itself, was moved by barge over to Falls Pass. They decided that that was not the location, and maybe water had something to do with it. I don't know if they had a water problem over there or what, but after 2 years of operation in Morshobe Bay, they put what barge, well, the old little penal bunkhouse. The store, by the way, the present store, that's part of the old Filipino bunkhouse. There was two of them. And actually they were in sort of in halves. So they was able to put them in barges and move over, what was it, four parts, I guess, the old Filipino bunkhouse. And there were some of the houses that are there, maybe number one, very well could have been built in Marshall Bay and barged over, but definitely those bunkhouses were, and they moved over then to Falls Pass either 1918, and I think it was moved in 1918, so that then the cannery, it was 1916 and in Marshall Bay, but then and they got a lease. And actually, Unimac Island had been already a game preserve, but they got it's not a lease. Some people think it's a lease, but it is not a lease. They got patent on land. The patent means just like a deed down here in Washington State, but for the purpose of a salmon cannery to take out of a wildlife refuge. And Nichols, you mentioned earlier about Nichols Point. Nichols was an early superintendent, maybe the first superintendent there. And P.D. Harris, Prince Edward Harris, was around there too. Cap Davis, Don Davis, was superintendent back in the 30s. I don't know how long. Maybe you could talk to Roland Davis about that, who just retired from Peter Pan Seafoods. That was his uncle, was the superintendent at Falls Pass. I believe around N, Harry Lowell was the bookkeeper. And then Harry Lowell, I believe, becomes superintendent around 1941. And he was superintendent for about 13 years. And 1953 was his last year. I was on a tender then. And Nick Bez was still operating the floater, the La Merced, a four-masted sailing ship, but did have a small diesel engine in it. And they would travel Port Polar, South Unimac, Falls Pass, and they actually tied up to our dock at Falls Pass in 1953 and processed fish there. And they had the Martinez land boats fishing for them primarily. And again, Falls Pass is getting most of all our fish from traps. And traps, they had two traps in Yucatan Bay, number 8 and number 10. Jorge Larson, when he first came to this country in 1950, he was a watchman on one of the traps in Yucatan Bay. We also had a trap at Yucatan Point, the common called Cape Horn, which was number 3. Their what they call their $1 million trap was their trap in East Anchor Cove, number 5. Even years when the Pinks ran, they would drive. These were all pile traps, by the way. It took a while to drive them, and then they'd have to be pulled every year. So we had a driver and a puller that would have to drive these traps. And we drive two down at Pavlov Bay, one at Settlement Point. But we would put them in every year, we put them in every other year down there. PIF had traps on Unimac Island. They had one at the old Yucatan Village, and they also had one around the corner of Cape Horn there, what they call the Salmon Ranch trap there, and the Boiler Point trap over in Oshodu Bay. But anyway, Harry Lowe's last year was 1953. Mendez had bought the cannery 2 years before, but sort of let it run under the old management. But then when he tied up, then the La Merced, he took the La Merced crew, which Bill Lilly had been on, and Mickey D'Artina, you know, and some of the old gang there, and they come ashore in 1954, and Bill Lilly becomes the superintendent in 1954, and Don Wallace, and later on becomes superintendent, Paul Sassus, the storekeeper. And and that was Harry Slow's last year, was 1953. And Bill Lilly was actually superintendent for 2 years, become general superintendent. And then 56, 57 was Carl Paulus. And then starting in 58 through 1974 was Don Wallace. And 74, 75 was Miss Bill Bright was there both in years, but actually, I think he took over 75. Bill Bright did there because Wallace and moved to Fort Moeller. And then Bill Bright stayed. He was operating years at the cannery. And then as a fish camp afterwards, up to in the year 2000.
Hey Bill, let's talk a little more about the traps. I'm curious, what time of year would a crew first go to Paul's Pass and start getting ready for the fishing season?
Yeah, March. There's a lot of work with traps. You had a web gang and you had a wire gang, and then they had to be driven, and you had the tool piling. I got in a little bit in 56 when I went as a deck hand on the Emily after the ice effect finished its season. We were about the first week in August for nice deck days, so then I switched over to the Emily. So I wound up, you know, sort of interesting, difficult for me to run across, which I referred to as a log boom that was piling. You know, say in the middle of the night, you know, because I had a hard time standing up on those piling where other guys used to it, and just, you know, just run like cats across those piling, and we hook up lines and we tow them. I know we've been a bunch of piling that are towed back from Pavlov Bay up to back up the Falls Pass. But anyway, in March, and the weather was not very good up there in the March, but they in the buildings, they'd have a wire gang and a web gang, and of course then the tenders, the Emily, and the Mershovi, and the Trojan, these tenders that could also tow the pile driver and, you know, and the puller afterwards. But the driver, we had a ways north of the cannery with some of the small boats. And I know the tenders, the glass after the ice effect, were pulled up there too, but some of the small boats, but also the driver and the puller was pulled up against sidetrack. And an old donkey engine there, and John Hodiakoff was the fireman, you know, with an old steam engine, donkey engine. Ways, you'd have to shovel a sand off the ways every time you launched or pulled up a boat, you know, to shovel off the sand, and then you've got a marine ways uncovered and marine ways, and you drop your driver down, and And drivers was used, you know, before trucks and all that around land moving equipment, you know, in 1918 or so. You didn't have the good land moving equipment, so a lot of stuff was done by drivers. Like they said that some of the first piling of False Pass was driven by a driver, which is land now. It's been filled in. All of the Podiakovs' house there now is water where you could come in with a driver and actually drive piling for the dock. And one thing about having a driver around, you could also do dock repair. If there's a piling knocked out on your dock in any place or the oil dock, pull your driver in there and drive some piling. These pile bucks was real handy guys. You know, I see where Arkowski, he was a, you know, a deckhand on one of the drivers when he first started, and then he wound up as a beach boss there at Falls Pass in the late 70s. But there were other guys, real characters, out here, and with a bottle of whiskey in one hand and a sledgehammer in another. But anyway, it was a lot of work to drive those traps, and it wasn't, you just couldn't drive them just any place where they wouldn't fish, right? You have to know what he was doing when you drove them. But then they'd hang the wire on the lead. And the lead there was jade about a mile long and number five. The trap was way out in the bay about a mile from the beach. And so you had a lead about a mile. And fish, when they hit an obstruction, have a tendency to head for deep water. And so when they come along the shore, an obstruction, they always go for the deepest, so that's where the trap was. And the trap was sort of a wide entrance going in, but very narrow, almost just wide enough for the fish to slide through into the trap. Well, anyway, then they'd have a hard time finding that. It had been possible to find that narrow opening to swim out of the trap. So when they was in the trap, then they would just scoot around and slide. Actually, some people was opposed to eliminating the traps. About for more fishermen, resident fishermen, the fish, but the quality that fish were alive when they was pulled out,
right,
and hauled to the canneries, and that's before they had the refrigeration. So some people said, oh, the quality of the pack is going to go way down. New England used to have a saying on their cans, canned with a wiggle in their tail, which wasn't too far from the truth. But then, after the traps were pulled, or the last year of fish traps in Alaska, his statehood was a sort of a political issue in the state, that the fishermen that lived in the Petersburgs and the Sitkas and the Valdezes and the Cordovas and Bristol Bay, the traps were owned by the companies and they had no financial benefit from them at all, and the catching fish they could catch with their same boats. So that was a political thing, to rid of the traps. But as it was, refrigeration came by soon after. You know, it was just ice. They used to ice fish from Bristol Bay and haul down on power scows. But that was a problem. It was some bad weather and all the fish were lost, you know, in transit. But then they developed circulating seawater, chilled seawater on his fingers, and that's what they have now. So fish could be caught and actually held for 5, 6, 7 days in refrigerated circulating seawater. so it processed it real well.
So when would the traps be pulled in the fall? And when would the whole season be over then?
Yeah, well, in August, you know, about the same time that it is now, they would pull, start pulling the traps about the 18th of August.
And that went pretty fast pulling them, probably.
No, you have to let a puller have, okay, gens. I lost that word, gens. The driver had gens, so you'd drop a sledgehammer down on top of the piling and drive it into the sand or to the bottom. And to pull a trap, you have also gens that you sort of wrap around the piling, and then somehow you'd wiggle it. You would, you know, wrap a line around the piling, and then you'd wiggle and pull and push and this and that, and you snap the piling, and then sometimes she would shoot up, but you had a hold of it with the gens, and then you'd lay her off to the side and do a move. But if you left them in the water year round, they'd get broken off, or ice or something would get them, so they were always pulled.
So did you ever work on that process, Bill?
You know, no, I didn't drive on a driver. I railed traps.
Right.
Actually, at 53, when I went on the Eisenbeck, we picked up seine fish out of Eisenbeck Bay from local seiners, mainly. And, okay, the tender was not rigged braille. We couldn't braille a trap if we wanted to with a tin can, Eisenbeck glass, and boats. You have to have a special boat. And you didn't braille traps with power scows either. It was the sort of house aft, and the fish hold forward, and there was a skill to it, you know, that the people knew, the guys that ran. Alf Larson was, they had in the cannery, they had a cannery foreman. They also had an outside foreman. And the outside foreman, when I was up there in 56, was Alf Larson, and he'd been there quite a few years. And he would, he was skipper also on the Emily. But he they had the Trojan and they had the Machovy to also braille traps. The Emily was the larger of the one, maybe the flagship of the fleet. But he would tell the other skippers, go braille that when it's ready, or, you know, this and that. But they had watchmen on those traps, too, that they stayed out there. Well, they had things to do. One thing about a trap was, this was federal, because this is the territory of Alaska. All during the trap days, the state would come in there, and then the traps are out. But federal law was the traps had to be closed on a weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And they had, a Sunday curtain, they called it that. But anyway, you drop it down where the fish could not get into the trap on a Saturday, and on a Sunday it would swim by. So the watchman had to pull some nets up and down. Also make sure that the traps weren't robbed, and there were people lost on traps, those storms had come up, and they lived in a very little shack on the end.
Yeah, that must have been exciting.
And storms had come up, especially in southeastern. The water was too deep, and they used a floater. They would use floating traps, but they all had a little house on the end. and they have a, you know, an category on the trap, and sometimes a storm will come up and break up the trap, and more times than not, we were able to get to the dory and get ashore, which is not too far away, but there were some drownings.
Now, Borgi and John Udikoff, they were mates down, I mean, I've heard some history about them. They were down on the trap down there near, at the head of the bay, where Stanley's mother's buried there. And what do they call that place? Johnson's?
Yeah, Johnson's, I guess.
The Johnson's, that's true, right? I know Borgi was...
usually you had two watchmen on a trap. And they cooked, and it was isolated. They didn't come to town. Actually, see, okay, the traps, although you'd work on them. Well, you'd have to have them in by the 5th of June or so, preferably the 1st of June. And they'd go out on a trap, and then they could stay until the 20th of August. So June, July, and, almost 3 months. And, an old story was they did put some radios on those traps where they could talk to the cannery. An old radio and a trap watchman, I guess, and number five, they would order some grub for the tender to bring out with a next trip. And I think he said 2 pounds of hamburger, 10 pounds of potatoes, a Playboy magazine, and some Jergens lotion. But that's what one of the trap watchmen ordered.
Yeah.
But I don't know what they needed the Jergens lotion for. They figured that one out. But anyway, they had some, and it was a rough, tough bunch. And they did have some work. Okay, there's seaweed would come up, kelp and all that, get into the lead, and they'd have to get in their dory, and they'd go down the lead and pull the kelp out of the, because the fish coming by seeing kelp, they turn around and swim ahead of time out around it, so you had the work to do there.
What about seals? Whales?
Seals, okay, and yeah, the tribe, sea lions and whale, and seals to get in the trap. And actually, truthfully, they were shot in 10 days.
Yeah.
They were predators, and legally you could shoot them if they got in your trap. And bear on the beach, and actually, it's probably was a good old time by. Companionship, you'd have to get along with your trap mate there.
Well,
you couldn't really fight that much, I guess.
Well,
right?
Stanley told me a story about Borgi and John Udikoff, and I wish I could remember, but it was something about them, how they managed to get along down there. That's the problem. I should have had a tape recorder on, too, when he was talking about that. Well, how about, now you told me one time about, just as an example, you told me about what's called the number one building now was one time the woman's mess hall, woman's cookhouse, but you said that, and that's what the real old-timers tell me, but you say when you first went there, it was sort of the machinist liquor store or something.
Well, the foreman, okay, 1953, the foreman, he's a neat guy, Erickson, he's the second there, was his last name, and he'd been there for quite a few years. Carson Erickson was his name. And,
he was the foreman, you think?
He was the foreman of the cannery.
Okay.
And he was going to be the winterman. Okay, in 1953, I was on the GLASNAP. And, the fish on the north side of the peninsula ended before the south side did. There was a pink run on the south side that the traps would still fish, but the chums and a few reds would get in Isenbeck Bay. It's all done by the first week in August. The canners stayed open until about the 21st of August or so, or 24th, around in there. So it was a couple more weeks. So I come ashore, that we pulled the GLASNAP up side tractor, and as it was, I wound up going down to Jim B that year, tender to Jim B that we had. We were hauling fish from Bristol Bay, so it had been rail traps, so we were hauling fish from Bristol Bay for Canyon. And Jim B was one of them, and I wound up going down south. But Briar Carson got a hold of me to, he was going to be the winter watchman and that winter, and he wanted his wife up there. And his house was number one, the Ganner Foreman's house. And he wanted it painted up for his wife to come up. So he asked me if I would paint it for him. So I painted the whole inside of number one, the kitchen, and actually it was sort of one big bedroom is what it was, and a kitchen there, and a bathroom. So I painted the inside. But the cannery was working late at the midnight or so, about every night. And I didn't beat off of the GLASNAP, on a tender. I didn't know too many of the people from ashore. You walk through the cannery, but you didn't get to know too many people. But that was sort of interesting. That he said, will you paint this for me? And it'd be a little longer season for me that way. And I said, yeah. And he said, anytime you want to drink the whiskey, and here's the bar right over here. And he had, as I recall, 7 or 8 bottles of whiskey sitting up there. And, but I wasn't into drinking in them days, Eddie. So I don't know if I touched it or not. I don't think I did. But anyway, these different machinists who were sort of prone to have a snifter or two once in a while, they would stop by and they knew where the bar was, and then they'd come in, pour themselves a drink, and they was going back to the retorts or going back to the fish house or the filler or something like that. And other people, wasn't only machinists, but maybe the carpenter, so would stop by. But I'd get the chance to meet them or so, or talk to them, or, BS a little bit. They're all colorful characters. So while I was painting this house, they're sort of interesting, and I got to meet, the sort of machinist crew. I think a couple of cooks snuck down there a few times to have a snort. But that was sort of the way it was back in the old days there. That was 1953.
And what about some of the other buildings around then, Bill? Now they built the, I always was told those, the motels and the newer, the machinist bunkhouse that was up towards the motel. I was always told those were put up in the, 1950 or something. Is that correct? Was that going on when you were there?
Yeah, I think the machinist bunkhouse was built around 53 in there. I tell you what, in 98, they had another fire at Falls Pass. They had a two-story building.
Go ahead.
The present mess hall is, and also covering where, the net lockers are now and the showers for the fishermen are now. There was a real nice building, a two-story building. The front of it was the store. On the bottom floor was the store, and it was quite a large store. Upstairs, right on top, was the superintendent's quarters. In back of that building was the mess hall and seating for the mess hall, the cookhouse. Upstairs, the machinists and carpenters all lived. They had some very nice quarters up above the mess hall. And it was quite a large building. But they had built that. Actually, it was more of a building, I think, which later called the machinist bunkhouse, was built more like for fishermen, because I remember Arnold Rasmussen, a fisherman from Port Moeller, was also a good carpenter. I remember in 53 now, them building that building. I don't think it was built, and I know it was not built as a machinist bunkhouse. They had their own nice bunkhouse
out
there. And that burned down in the winter of 58, the whole thing. So they had to do something with the store, so they moved the store down into the old part of the machinist Filipino bunkhouse. See, at one time there, they had a big Filipino crew there. They needed more men, but the machinery did, eliminate a lot of jobs then, and so they didn't need quite that big a crew. So they took one quarter of the bunkhouse as the store. They got a very cheap from Olympic prefab mess hall that they built, and over where the old store was, and there was a cookhouse in there. It was a storage room where the guys hang their nets now. Was sort of a storage room for supplies, corn and pears and peaches and all that. It was also a storeroom for the store too. But ahead of that, the cook lived there. There was a couple of cooks and some quarters in there, and then the stove and the galley. And then beyond that, where the lockers are now for the fishermen, was actually the mess hall. Okay, the Filipinos had their own mess hall. They ate down in part of the Filipino bunkhouse. So it was a divided crew after 58. When we rebuilt in 77, we had to hurry up and put a new mess hall in. So that's when the new mess hall, present mess hall, was built. And there was some things about discrimination and separate mess halls, even though the Filipinos would have always preferred to eat in their own mess hall, their own type of food. They were unhappy with the situation, but lawsuits and this and that, the company decided, and I guess rightly so, made one big mess hall with the Filipino cooks to do special cooking for them, and other Caucasian cooks to cook for the others. And then we built, we decided to build a new Filipino bunkhouse and do over there. So the machinists, after 58, then they moved over into that building that was built not really as a machinist bunkhouse, but they moved over into what we call a machinist bunkhouse. But hasn't been used, this grows up there, but it's a sort of a nice wooden building.
Now, people say there were a lot of houses. Dennis Jackson told me that his old family lived in the number one there, maybe in the 60s, I don't know. And Stanley was telling me that in front of the motels there were just a whole bunch of houses there, and they were family houses, and people from Icatan and Mortovi Village and Sanac and all around would come and spend the summer at Fall Pass and work in the cannery. And also, you could talk about that, and also I know that some of the local guys, like, John Shelikov's grandpa, or John Shelikov's, what was his name? Sakhar. And some of those other characters, didn't a few of them live also on the beach, maybe up towards the pile drivers? Anyway, some of these little buildings, were there a lot of them when you first went there?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say a lot, but there were some, you know, we had the Radio Shack there that later become Nave's house there. There was another little shack there that Mickey D'Artino used to stay in, but that sort of fell down. There were other houses, a couple little houses around there, about the size of Tin Can, and where Dennis Machette stayed. Some even littler than that. There weren't that many more. There was, you know those houses there. But there were probably four or five houses. Okay, where?
Well, we tore down two of them for the mess hall.
The mess hall and the bunkhouse. Okay, I was thinking maybe not the mess hall, but the bunkhouse, but maybe we did. I know where there were along that boardwalk there where the Filipino bunkhouse went in, and there were a couple houses along that boardwalk.
Right, John Hudikoff lives in one of them, I know, because I helped tear it down.
Yeah.
How about out on the beach towards the pile driver?
Ferguson's, I remember Sophie Ferguson and Johnny, and I guess Henry before, in just a little shack. You know, actually, there were some, Peter Yashmanoff one time sort of lived in an old trap shack. You know, okay, when the traps went out, that there were shacks, on those traps. And,
right, and one of them still on that, where the old mess hall building that now have the fishermen's showers and stuff. Isn't that an old trap shack that's stuck on the one side? So I think somebody told me it was. Maybe not. It's fallen down now, but it's a little, kind of got a sloped roof on it. A little bit of a rounded roof, and it's probably...
You said south of the beach house? No, that one's south.
North. It's right next to the beach house, just to the north. And it's stuck on a couple of piling there. It's just a little, probably 10 by 10.
Yeah. That was,
that was from a trap.
Yeah, and then I think we used that as sort of a cool room or so for the mess hall there.
Well, we better talk about some of these characters.